Good afternoon, all. I have a quorum here?
Yes.
Yes, so we do.
Yeah, all right. Welcome to the November 5th Tompkins County Legislature meeting. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance.
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call of members.
Martha Robertson?
Here.
Mike Sigler?
Here.
Shauna Black?
Here.
Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Henry Granison?
Present.
Rich John? Rich John? Anna Kellis?
Here.
Dan Klein?
Here.
Dan Corman?
Present.
Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna? Glenn Morey?
I am here.
Rich John?
Here.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Present.
You have 13 members present.
Thank you. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. If there are any communications, you would have received them, or they're in your mailboxes. I have some proclamations for today. And so I'm looking to see who might be present.
Oh. J.R. Sam.
Sam
came in.
I'm looking to see if Chief Sam George is present.
He is right there, yes.
Okay. So we'll start with our Native American Heritage Month proclamation. And we invited Chief Sam George to say a few words prior to reading the proclamation at his request. Chief? Uh-oh, did they disappear?
Yeah.
Looks like they might have gotten disconnected. So I will go ahead and read the proclamation and hopefully they'll be able to join us again. So whereas indigenous peoples settled, inhabited, and were caretakers of the Americas for thousands of years, and whereas we recognize the fact that Tompkins County currently occupies lands where prior to the invasion of European settlers, they were the homes and villages of the Cayuga Nation and Onondaga Nation of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And the Haudenosaunee Confederacy also includes the Mohawk, Oneida, Seneca, and Tuscarora nations, and that these nations stretch from present-day Albany to Buffalo. And whereas on August 3rd, 1990, President George H.W. Bush declared the month of November as National American Indian Heritage Month, thereafter commonly referred to as Native American Heritage Month, the bill read in part that the president, in quotes, the president has authorized and requested to call upon federal, state, and local governments, groups, and organizations, and the people of the United States to observe such month with appropriate programs, ceremonies, and activities. And whereas the county acknowledges that throughout our history, they have been and continue to be periods of pain, tragedy, inequity, bigotry, and injustice against indigenous peoples, And while we acknowledge that history, we must also recognize that today and into the future, we must take action to make changes for the better. And whereas the county has begun this change movement by committing through its diversity policy and all the non-discrimination policies to oppose the systemic racism towards all marginalized peoples, including indigenous peoples in our region. And whereas, in demonstration of this commitment, on Tuesday, July 17, 2018, the Tompkins County Legislature unanimously voted to recognize the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day, encouraging the celebration of this day in a manner that promotes respect, understanding, and friendship, combats prejudice and bias, works to eliminate discrimination stemming from colonization, and acknowledges our history. And whereas in so doing, Tompkins County pledged to foster meaningful relationships with our tribal nations, recognizing and valuing the many contributions, past and present, made to our community through Indigenous peoples' knowledge, labor, technology, science, philosophy, arts, and the deep cultural contribution that helped shape the character of our county. And whereas this month, the Tompkins County Legislature encourages all residents to honor and celebrate the traditions, stories, languages, and full culture of our tribal nations, and more specifically, Tompkins County's indigenous roots, history, and contributions. Now, therefore, upon recommendation of the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, I, Leslie McBean, Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do proclaim November 2020 as Native American Heritage Month in Tompkins County and call upon all county residents to commemorate this month with appropriate programs and activities and to renew our commitment to ensure that the rich histories and contributions of our indigenous peoples can thrive. Signed this fifth day of November, 2020. Thank you, and I see Chief Sam George has been able to rejoin us. Thank you, Chief, for joining us. I'm sorry our technology kicked you off there for a moment.
Can you hear me?
Words. Yes, we can. Go ahead.
First of all, I missed the words before all else because of technical difficulties. it's what we say when we have meetings with outside people and we meet other nations and other groups of people. And there's going to be some kind of meeting among us. So we usually say the words before all else so that everyone on our side and your side come to one mind and understand that what we're doing is of one mind. And to be thankful for all those things that Mother Nature has given us, the plants starting up from the ground, working their way up to the trees, the strawberries, the trees, the animals, the four-leggeds, the two-leggeds, the water, all the animals in the water, and from there we move on up to the flying beings, to the winds, to the thunders, to the sun, to the moon, and to the Creator Himself and those that watch over us and keep us keep us on the right path. So we give thanks for all of those things, and we bring all our minds to one. That's all the wording. Maybe I'll get a chance to say it at the end of the meeting, because we say it before the meeting and we say it after the meeting, so that people are reminded of the same thing, that we give thanks for all of those things every time, every day, all day. I gave thanks this morning. I said the same thing this morning. I'll probably say it again before I go to bed so I don't forget. And that after hearing the proclamation, There was a few. I didn't get the draft before it got read, but it seems to be acceptable, I would think. My wife told me to be nice, so I'm doing like the best I can. Some of you will understand that meaning. So, thank you. Thank you all for what you're doing and what you're doing. And hopefully that wherever we go and wherever we meet each other, that we understand who we are and where we are, and that we can do this together, whatever it is we need to do, in the right way, hit it in the right direction. Because one of my biggest things that I hope that the legislature and all of those that are important people in Tompkins County and all the surrounding the lake is that we need to keep the water clean, we need to keep the air clean, and we need to keep our ground so that it doesn't shatter on us and sink us somewhere. That is some of the things that is going on right now, and hopefully none of you will get hurt from it because of what other people have done. So hopefully they will not do that anymore. Mother Nature, she doesn't like, she has her own laws, you know, and that we try to pay attention to her laws as well as ours. And sometimes they coincide, and that we don't want to hurt her any more than what she wants to hurt us. So with that, I give thanks again for our thanks word is I give now to everyone here tonight, and appreciate the things that you guys are doing. Now,
thank you, Chief Sam George. Much appreciated.
Sachem Sam George.
And again, apologies for the technical difficulties there.
No, it's my fault. It's not yours.
We appreciate you being here, and our regards to everyone as well. Thank you for reminding us that if we protect Mother Nature, she will protect us as well, and we will do our best. So thank you very much. We'll make sure that this proclamation is delivered to you, that you all can have it in your hands. So we'll make sure that happens. So thank you for joining us today.
Sure.
And our next proclamation that I have here is proclamation recognizing Home Care Aid Appreciation Week. And I will read it. Whereas the County of Tompkins, New York, recognizes the nearly 300 home health aides who provide care to hundreds of residents in our area, and whereas home health aides provide high quality and compassionate health care services to those in need, especially at times of crises, and whereas home health aides work conscientiously to provide services and care, enabling individuals to remain in their homes and live as independently as possible, and whereas home health aides are vital members of our health care team and improve the quality of life of our older citizens, people with disabilities, and their families, whereas November is National Home Care and Hospice Month, and November 8th through November 14th is National Home Care Aid Week, and whereas the Health Planning Council of Tompkins County, home care agencies, and other organizations in this community are sponsoring activities in recognition of the contributions of the home health care aides, now therefore I, Leslie McLean Clearborn, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the full second week of November 2020 as Home Care Aid Appreciation Week in Tompkins County, and urge all citizens of this community to honor and celebrate this special event, signed this fifth day of November 2020. And we thank our home health care workers for the incredible work that they do. This has special meaning to me, I will say, because my mother, when she migrated to this country, that was her first job as a home health care worker. And she did an amazing job of it with such care and compassion. And I also experienced some of that myself when I moved to Ithaca and the care that our home health care aide provided to the late Julia Diane Sams. So thank you, home care workers, who home health care aides, who is here to receive this proclamation. Anybody here for it? I want to thank Mike Lane for bringing this to our attention. Thank you. We will make sure that our health aid workers know that they are appreciated. Shauna Black.
Yes, I also wanted to thank Frank Proto. He brought this resolution to us, or the proclamation to us, and revamped it from years past. And I just wanted to add, as far as my gratitude, I've worked in healthcare for many years, and I've actually followed home health aides around trying to understand their job. And I will say without a doubt, this is one of the hardest jobs out there, and unfortunately one of the lowest paying jobs too. So we thank the 300 home health aides that serve our Tompkins County residents, and we know that you're working very, very hard to not just keep people at home, but to keep people safe and healthy. And every day you leave your family and go to a job that sometimes isn't always rewarding. And it's a very hard job, and we recognize that, and we thank you for that. So thank you for what you do. I also wanted to let our legislature know that Dominic and Amy Hendricks will be making posters for our TCAP buses that are showing our appreciation as a county for the hard work that our healthcare workers are doing. So I wanted to let everyone know that as well.
Yay. And thank you, Shauna, and thank you as well, Frank Proto, former legislator Proto. And our last proclamation for this evening is a proclamation honoring Tompkins County veterans. Whereas the Congress of the United States set aside November 11th of each year as a legal public holiday to honor our nation's veterans, and whereas since 1919, our country has paused at, quote, the 11th hour of the 11th month of the 11th day to respect and recognize the diligence, duty, and sacrifice committed faithfully by the people who don the uniforms of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and their reserve components, including the National Guard. And whereas each Veterans Day provides an opportunity to remember and honor the courage, valor, and dedication of those who served our nation, as well as those who continue to serve, and to thank them for defending our rights and protecting the freedom of our country. And whereas Tompkins County joins in that commemoration with its leaders conveying our deepest gratitude and paying tribute to all of these individuals, especially those who consider Tompkins County home, by communicating our sincere appreciation for their extraordinary contributions through this proclamation and other recognition efforts. And whereas also acknowledging November as Native American Heritage Month, and that Tompkins County lies in ancestral lands of the Cayuga Nation, we applaud the opening this Veterans Day of the National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. And whereas in this year, where a national pandemic has shuttered many doors and isolated many of the county's residents, we extend our thanks to the myriad of dedicated services available throughout our county for the federal, state, and county, from the federal, state, and county governments, as well as the nonprofit community for our veterans, active military members, and their families. And whereas the vast workforce of Tompkins County's governance comprises veterans, active duty, and reserve military service members representing every branch of the United States Armed Forces, now therefore I, Leslie McBean Clearpoint, as chairwoman of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim this a season to celebrate, and in the words of the Veterans Administration, quote, honor Americans' veterans for their patriotism, love of country, and willingness to serve and sacrifice for the common good, end quote. Be it further resolved that I call upon all who live in and frequent the County of Tompkins to join us and join me in this legislature in honoring said constituency, particularly those who are also are Tompkins County employees, with a simple but heartfelt thank you, and pause in honor at 11 a.m. during this observance on Veterans Day on November 11th, 2020, signed this fifth day of November 2020. Thank you to our veterans for their service, and thank you. And here, I believe, to accept this proclamation is J.R. Clearpoint, the Director of Tompkins County Veterans Services Department or Agency. J.R.?
Hey, good evening, everybody.
Good evening. And
thank you, Madam Chairwoman, for the reading the proclamation. On behalf of our veterans community, we do thank you, the legislature, as well as everyone in Tompkins County, for the recognition and support that's given of our veterans community. I've passed, what is it, I think 15th, I'm in my 15th month in this position with Veteran Services, and my phone rings quite a bit. There's other things that are happening, and just trying to make sure that people know that Tompkins County is and does have a Veteran Services agency that's here to serve our community. A lot of the families reach out just as much as the veterans do. And I think particularly in this time of the pandemic, where there's concerns about some of our veterans who are, some are isolated. Some are isolated, can't get out. Everybody, a lot of people can't get out. But I always encourage everybody, and I'll extend the same to you, to use the buddy system. When we're in, when I was in the Navy, whenever we had a Liberty port, you had to leave with your buddy, and you come back with your buddy. And that's simple as that. And you used using a buddy check. You just call on your buddy, whether it's your neighbor, your friend, someone you've not seen in a while. Just call on them from time to time, just to say hello, check in, and they'll do the same with you. That way we all make sure that we're here. So, but thank you for this opportunity, and thank you again for the proclamation.
Thank you, JR.
Leslie?
Yes.
I just wanted to mention that in our group, I know we have some veterans, and we ought to thank them as well.
Yeah.
David McKenna.
Yeah.
And Jason Molino, and if there's anybody I've forgotten, please speak up. Deborah Dawson, of course, and anyone else? The three of you, thanks for what you've done for us.
Agreed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for honoring those who are present with us today as well. One thing I do want to point out, and I know that Sachem Sam George was still here, is thank you, Jared, for this proclamation and bringing awareness to us. I didn't know this, that there is the opening of the Native Americans, National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. That is was a very good information to share, so thank you for that. All righty. Moving on with the rest of our meeting. We are going to have an executive session tonight to discuss personnel matters in relation to particular personnel. Is there any other reason for our executive session, Jason?
I wanted to give a quick update on the real estate matter.
Real estate, okay, as well as real estate leadership matter. Thank you very much. privilege of the floor for the public. Is there any public who would like to speak to us? Well, where is our public? How come they're not speaking to us anymore? We're going to have to work on that, Deborah. Okay, municipal officials, and I did see George. Who else did I see? Anybody else? George McGonigal from City of Ithaca Common Council, representing the First Ward. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Leslin. Good evening, everybody.
Evening.
I just got back from the beauty parlor.
I can tell. Your eyebrows look wonderful.
I didn't have time to clean up after work, but I'm here. I don't have a long report today. On behalf of my colleagues, I'd like to congratulate Anna Kellis in her victory on Tuesday. Hopefully that will bring great things to the county and the city. So good luck in Albany, Anna.
Thank you, George, so much.
The Common Council officially passed the city budget last night. We added to the mayor's proposed budget with a part-time position at GIAC and with two police officers that were budgeted for last year, but there were eight positions that were not included in the mayor's budget this year. We added back two that will start on the 1st of July, so basically a half a year, because money is so incredibly tight this year, as you know. Southside got more money than they've gotten in the past, and that is because they're significantly adding some services, particularly on West Hill in the First Ward, which I'm quite excited about. Some grassroots efforts to provide programming for children after school. I'm going to put out some information about that in the near future in case any of you want to participate in that effort. This is the first year I've been on the GIAC board, which I'm enjoying very much, and I'd just like to share with you the fact that the GIAC's annual meeting will be December 3rd, starting at 5:30 p.m., and I believe there will be dinners to go. Is that right, Leslin?
Mr. Board Member, I do not know.
Okay. I don't know for sure either, but I think there will be. But more detail forthcoming. But it will be December 3rd in about a month. And since we're celebrating all things November, I'd just like to wish everybody a happy Guy Fawkes Day, which is today.
I expected that. Thank you, George. Any questions for George or comments? Don't you bring the humor every time? Henry.
Yes, George. Do you know whether, because I read some different things about the adding of the police, whether they'll be able to actually hire anybody for those two spots?
That will depend on the civil service list. The chief, the last time he spoke on this subject, was optimistic that there's good candidates. So I'm hoping the answer is yes, but if they don't find somebody that they really think is going to be good, they won't hire somebody until they find somebody who candidates that they think will be really good officers.
Okay, thank you.
But we're optimistic that, yes, they will be hired.
Any other questions or comments for George? I'll take a shot. George, I thank you for mentioning the South Side, but I also want to give a big shout-out and share with this legislature the work that Harry Smith has been doing with Black Hands Universal, because this has been, you know, his brainchild. Harry is a returning citizen who has really taken this seriously in making sure that there are opportunities for children, and particularly children of color, to continue their education without barriers, whether it's not having internet services at home or needing that extra adult tutoring. So partnering with the Southside Community Center, or coming under the umbrella of the Southside Community Center, I do want to give big kudos to Harry for moving in this direction and his dedication to seeing this happen.
Yes, Harry's been doing a really good job. I've known Harry since he was a second grader. He worked for me one summer. And he's really putting in a lot of time, and he, when he reaches some kind of roadblock, he goes over it. He really is doing impressive work. There's two things in particular that he's working on now. One, they're tutoring classes for kids. One is up and running, and it's at the Just Because, the former Ithaca Paint building, and they're donating their space for this effort. And then Harry and a bunch of volunteers, including Anthony Hayton, who lives at West Village, are preparing the community room at West Village for a second tutoring and after-school activities program. And they're going to, I think they've got some money from Cornell and from IC, and they've got computers, but they need some help in setting those computers up if anybody's interested. They'll be doing that this weekend. But this is an exciting, positive thing for West Hill and the people who live here.
Thank you, George, and thanks to the city for its support of that work. Clearly, they're, you know, still looking for support in all kinds, whether you want to help donate school supplies or, you know, finances. I know that they will take that. So please check them out and donate if you're able to. Rich John.
Thank you. George, thanks for coming to the meeting and reporting. Really appreciate it. And congratulations on getting the city budget done. I understand how difficult this year has been. I was curious if there was any news on RIBS, the bicycle program, or the Newman Golf Course. Any significant changes on either one of those?
Well, RIBS is overseen by Southside Community Center, and I think they plan on reopening. I'm not sure exactly when, and I don't know if it's going to be the same staff that was there before, but, I think the best answer you could get for that question would be from the board of directors at Southside. But they are planning on reopening. I'm not sure when. The golf course, I don't think we're going to close it, and I'm hoping that 2021, the golf course will be up and running.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, George. As always, thank you for coming and reporting. And ditto what Rich said, congratulations on passing the budget.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we're on to privileges of floor for legislators. Michaeline?
I'd like to add my voice to the congratulations to Anna Kellis for her election. Anna, whether you know it or not, I think you broke the curse. And the curse is that people on our legislature have not had a very good track record of being elected to higher office. And that includes me. Not since, I think, the 1980s when Sam McNeil and Gary Lee, who had served on this legislature, made it to higher office, has anyone until now, until your election, been able to take on a state or federal elected office position. So we're glad you broke the curse, and we look forward to working with you as make your way into state government, which I think you'll find to be a wonderful experience. And the other thing I want to mention for everyone and the public is that with Anna going up to Albany, that means there's going to be a vacancy at some point, her choice, on the on this legislature, which is going to need to be filled by a special election. And we hope that folks in her district who are interested in running will begin looking at the process. We'll have to set that election at some point. This legislature will. I think we have two or three people in the legislature now who have initially come on special elections. So it's not a new process, but it's one we have to educate the public about each time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Amanda?
Well, I was just going to see if Anna wanted to go next. She might want to follow up on that.
Yeah, I would love to, Amanda. Thank you. Yeah, I
wasn't going to call on Anna because there might be others of us who might want to say something before she opens her mouth. But all right.
No, I'll go last.
Go ahead, you already started.
Oh, I wanted to thank you, Mike, so much and everyone here. It has been five of the most educational, humbling, inspiring, uplifting, infuriating, and brilliant years of my life. Every emotion that I could have had, this experience has brought to me, and it has made me a better person. And I say that with all of my heart. I have truly been so honored to serve on the legislature, and there are very few people, as Mike pointed out, and Mike, thank you so much. I'm honored. There are very few people at the state legislature who have county experience. And one of the things, of course, that we know is that we have gotten so deeply hampered by unfunded mandates, and it has been grilled into me. Something that I understand in my heart, not just intellectually, but I've seen the impact on our community. And so bringing those experiences with me to the state, I hope to share with my colleagues and hopefully have some impact. Just know that I'm bringing you all with me. I will be across the street. My intention is to continue in the office and be very engaged because this is where my heart is. So thank you so much. Oh, the one other thing, Mike, that I did want to say is, I will be working hard to get the message out to everybody in my district because I do want this to feel really inclusive. And encourage anybody who's watching, please reach out to me. I will happily support anyone, give any information that I have. And the Fifth Ward and the Third Ward are supporting getting the message out as well. So I wanted to make sure that people knew that. And George, thank you so much, too. Thank you. You're definitely a very honorable human, and it has been an absolute pleasure to spar with you, disagree with you, and when we agree, to champion things with you. So thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Amanda.
Thank you. I just wanted to quickly give folks a book recommendation, which I've been reading, it's called Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants by Robin Wall Kimmerer. She is a mother, a scientist. She's a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. She's an environmental biologist who teaches at SUNY, and this book is changing my view on the world. It's really beautiful. They're short essays about she blends science with her native culture teachings, with stories about motherhood, with stories about, you know, family. I just really highly recommend it, especially considering the Native American Heritage Month. So it's called Braiding Sweetgrass. It's a wonderful book. Go out and buy it and read it. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Ann Corman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to first acknowledge that we occupy the lands of the Cayuga Nation, and I want to thank Sachem Sam George for joining us today and saying a few words. I'm hoping that he will be able to stay to the end of the meeting, and but, you know, depending on how long it takes, I understand if he can't. But maybe he could say a few words before we go into executive session, if you would allow. I also would like to congratulate Anna Kellis on being elected to the New York State Assembly. I really applaud your passion and dedication, not only in the campaign, but here at the legislature. It's been a pleasure working with you. I have learned quite a lot from you, and I know you will do well in representing us and a portion of Cortland County at the state legislature. So congratulations.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you, Ann. Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Leslie. And a quick add of my props to Anna. This is an amazing year to try to figure out how to campaign. I know everybody was thrown into, you know, like it's just a mind-boggling kind of moment in the middle of this campaign. So congratulations to all the candidates who figured it out. And in that vein, congratulations and thanks to our Board of Elections and the staff at the Elections Office. The early voting went well in Tompkins County. The absentee balloting seemed to go well. And I know that they'll be counting. They maybe already have set up in our chambers, or they will be taking over our chambers for probably a week or 10 days, maybe more, to do the counting. So thanks to our clerks for cohabitating with them. It's really quite a wonderful thing to have an election. And it feels like even though it's, you know, things aren't fully settled yet, which is totally understandable. It really seems like things went off pretty well around the country. There were so many unknowns and so many new processes that every community had to deal with. And I think we should all be proud of the amazing turnout that happened this year, and wish that we could have as good a turnout every election. One of my soapboxes is about the Electoral College. I think if we got rid of it, then more people would vote, because then everybody's vote would actually count. So just a little plug for that. Anyway, thanks again to our election staff and all the volunteers who helped them as well.
Thank you, Martha. I'm going to put myself in front of everybody next time, because everybody says everything I was going to say in my chair's report, and then there's nothing more for me to say. Anyhow, I do want to add my voice of congratulations to our colleague Anna Kellis on running a great campaign and winning this seat. Thank you, like Mike said, for breaking the curse. you know, might make me think about it. No, not really. but thank you. I do also want to give honor to an incredible woman who you will be replacing in Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton. Barbara has served us well in this county for going on 20 years as an Assemblywoman. I remember when she started and certainly has kept Tompkins County as a place that she paid keen attention to, listened to us. We have gotten some home rule legislation passed because she has championed them through the state, and we know that we can call on her at any time. And so I do want to honor and thank Barbara for that. And Anna, I know that you're going in your own shoes and your own big heart. And as Barbara did, you will keep us in the same vein. And we know that we can look forward to Tompkins County being well represented in the state assembly. So thank you for stepping up. Thank you for doing it. And thank you for the integrity that you will bring to that position just as much as Barbara Lifton did. I also want to just very quickly take a moment and give an announcement. I think George McGonagall might have, he left already, might have mistaken when the dinners are available. So on November 20th, GIAC is hosting its annual Harvest Fest dinner. No, it will not be in person, but you can pick up a free meal to go. We encourage all of the community who would have ordinarily, all 400-plus people who usually show up and enjoy the dinner, to please stop by, call GIAC, and reserve a meal. We prefer that you do that so it's ready to go and we don't have people piled up waiting for a meal to be dished up and served up. Turkey and all the trimmings, thanks to, you know, Chase Bank for their sponsorship, Wegmans for cooking and donating all the turkeys, and so many of our local restaurants, despite struggling in this pandemic, will continue to support this event so that members in our community can enjoy a free meal. It's free to anyone who would like a meal. So please pass the word on to your constituents and let folks know they can just call or email GIAC to reserve a meal. You can show up the day of, but just know that it might be a wait for you to get it. And if any one of you is interested in helping to deliver meals to your seniors who might be shut in or others, you know, please do call GIAC and let us know. We'll take you. We're going to do limited delivery depending on how many people we have and what capacity we have to do that. But we do encourage people to get a meal and still enjoy, you know, the harvest dinner. And we'll have a program running simultaneously on YouTube. The meals are served from 4:30 through 7:30, and the program will be on YouTube at around 6 o'clock. So just wanted to share that. Any other legislators? Okay. We'll move on. And this is the one I needed to thank you for, Mike. A special presentation or topic. We have the state Route 13 for the study. And thank you, Katie and Fernando and others who were waiting for it. Keith, thank you for your patience. And so why don't you and the other Katie go ahead and take it away. This is the State Route 13 Corridor Study by our consultants, Barton Lugidis. So please do go ahead.
Thank you so much, Leslyn. Nice to see everybody. Just wanted to bring this to you all. This is the final draft report of a study that the legislature funded in recognition that Route 13 is the main thoroughfare for commerce and commuting in the county, and it's really in all of our best interests to maintain the functionality and safety of that corridor. The purpose of the study really was to be proactive, raising awareness of the issues that are the corridor faces, highlighting possible solutions that we could implement, and then making it so that we can advocate for getting those solutions in place in recognition that it is a state road. It's not a county-owned road. We had a great steering committee with this group. There were four legislators on the steering committee. There were representatives from the involved municipalities, Cornell and TCAT, as well as New York State DOT had several people who attended the meetings and reviewed documents as well. We went through a really quite robust public outreach component for this study. We had a couple of surveys, many open houses and meetings, a big public meeting through Zoom in COVID times. And so what's being presented tonight is the final draft report. We'll be finalizing that after this meeting. And our consultants are here from Barton and Legutis. We've got Katie Darcy and Keith Ewald, who were the leads on this. Labella consultant was also involved, and Highland Planning. So, Katie, if you could take it away, please.
Great. Thanks, Katie. Thank you, everyone, for having us and giving us the opportunity to present some of the work we've been doing with Katie and Fernando over the past year or so. So we've got a lot of content to cover, so I won't waste any time here. And I will try to be as brief as possible. So I will share my screen. Ooh. Give me 1 second here. Share for a second. Sorry, having some technical difficulties. Can everyone see that all right?
Yes.
Great, thank you. Okay, so again, thanks for having us. We're gonna go through some of the results of our study relatively quickly here today, so I apologize if it's a lot of information at once, but there is a lot of additional detail and information in the report, which I believe you should all have at this point. So, and we will certainly take any questions once we are done with our presentation. So, like Kay said, we are from Barton and Legutis. We worked with Highland Planning and Labella to help create this corridor study. We are also very thankful for all the time and effort that our steering committee put into putting this project together. And just to go over quickly what we're going to go over, we're just going to talk about why we did this study, why it's important, how we engaged the public throughout the process, and then kind of get into some of the recommendations contained within the report. So this is our study area. I'm sure you're all familiar with this corridor. It's about 8.5 miles along State Route 13 between the village of Lansing on starting at Warren Road and then ending at Spring House Road at the edge of the village of Dryden. And, excuse me. So basically the reason why this study was undertaken was it was identified in the long-range transportation plan through the MPO that this was a corridor, a very significant green corridor for the county and the region as a whole. And it's important to take a look at it, see how it's functioning now, where there are deficiencies currently, as well as where there may be potential additional deficiencies as development continues within the region. So this is just a preliminary look at some of the issues and opportunities along the corridor and maybe some potential design solutions as well. So before we get into the meat of it, we think it's important always to share this infographic. Like Katie said, this is a state-owned road, so any design projects would go through several phases of review and revisions, and we are at the very beginning of that process. Like I said, it was identified in the long-range plan, and now we are going through this planning corridor study to give the county a sense of where they might want to improve the corridor and how they might want to go about that. So first we looked at some existing conditions along the corridor. We put some tube counters out in fall of 2019, so this was pre-COVID, and looked at traffic levels there and level of service analysis. We also looked at crash data over a five-year period and compared it to statewide averages for similar facilities. And then lastly, we also looked at it from a land use perspective. We looked at existing land use patterns, the existing development regulations within both the Village of Lansing and the Town of Dryden. And then we also looked at developing a potential development scenario for the next 10 years for the corridor. And again, we reached out to the public in many different ways throughout the process. This included interviews, stakeholder interviews, two surveys, a public drop-in session, a virtual public meeting once COVID came upon us, and several steering committee meetings throughout the project process. So our initial public survey we hosted online in early 2020. And thanks to the Highway Department, we actually advertised it on these variable message boards, which was great and helped contribute to getting us over 1,500 responses, which is pretty remarkable. I think that's the most survey responses I've ever seen on a project before. So that's great, all great information we got from the public. And unsurprisingly, the most significant issues that the public identified were safety, whether it's vehicular or multimodal users, and also just congestion. Given that this is a pretty significant commuting corridor, it tends to get backed up during the AM and PM peak periods. So I want to jump right into some of the strategies we've developed. And just as an overview, we kind of visioned this corridor as having two distinct character areas, one of which is west of the State Route 366 intersection between there and Warren Road. And this is definitely more developed, definitely has more development potential within the next 10 years, given its closer proximity to Cornell and the city of Ithaca. And it's just generally has higher traffic volumes. The second section is east of that intersection to the Village of Dryden, and is definitely more rural in character. We're not envisioning any significant development occurring within the next 10 years along that portion of the corridor, but certainly still important to take a look at that segment as well. So this study focuses primarily on intersection improvements, the reason for that being that when we looked at traffic and safety data, or crash data, excuse me, the most significant deficiencies occurred at the intersections themselves rather than the roadway segments between the intersections. So this was kind of our focus in terms of improving the corridor was at the intersections themselves. And you can see there are six key intersections, all of which happen to be within the western segment of the corridor. And then in addition to those, we had corridor-wide improvement strategies, which include multimodal accommodations, as well as some access management and zoning recommendations. So the three types of intersection strategies you'll see on the next couple slides are what we're calling recommended intersection enhancements. These are lower cost, and shorter term improvement strategies, probably can be accomplished with local dollars and accomplished in a quicker time frame, but still can have some positive effects on the way those intersections function. The second category of strategies are intersection configuration strategies, which are much more significant. This involves actually changing how the intersection is laid out and would include things like adding turning lanes, potentially installing a roundabout, and these would definitely require further traffic and engineering studies as well as several review processes. And then the last category here is multimodal intersection improvement strategies. So I'll get right into each of the intersections. I'll kind of briefly go over each of them, probably not every improvement strategy, but just to get you a sense of what we were looking at here. So Warren Road is definitely one of the most significant intersections, if not the most significant intersection along the study corridor. It had the highest crash rate along the corridor, which is 5 times higher than the average for statewide similar statewide facilities, which is pretty significant. And then in general, it's very congested, particularly during commuting periods. And it is quite a burdensome intersection to cross as a pedestrian. I tried it while we were out in the field once, and it was not pleasant, I'll say that. So our goal here was just to increase safety for all users and to reduce some of those delays. So we looked at, in terms of short-term strategies, things like improving visibility through lighting and signage, potentially retiming the signal program. And then in terms of bigger picture items, we were looking at installing additional turning lanes both on Warren Road as well as State Route 13. And I'm going to actually switch to the next slide here so you can get a visual sense of what that might look like. Just as a disclaimer, this is by no means a set-in-stone design concept. It's just an illustrative graphic to kind of show what it might look like. We included planted medians here to kind of help break up that pedestrian crossing length and time. And there's some other additional improvements contained on this. The second intersection moving east, we looked at Brown and Sapsucker Woods Road intersection. There's some congestion, especially for vehicles trying to turn onto the corridor from these secondary roads. And it has a higher crash rate than the statewide average. Actually, all of the intersections along this study corridor had higher crash rates than the statewide average. So that's something interesting to note. So at this intersection, we were looking at improving visibility through lighting, potentially signalizing this intersection to create dedicated time for turning movements, potentially installing a centered turn lane to remove those vehicles turning left on or off of the State Route 13 corridor from through traffic, and then this could be a potential candidate for a roundabout as well. And then, again, while I was out in the field, I noticed these three runners crossing the street, which did not look fun. So we also are recommending some additional non-motorist facilities. So this is just a conceptual diagram, less so of the signalized intersection, but the roundabout is just to get you a sense of what that might look like here. When developing these concept plans for roundabouts, we used a radius that would be appropriate for tractor-trailer traffic, just given that this is a pretty significant freight corridor for the county. Hanshaw Road was the next one we looked at. This was not mentioned as frequently as some of the other intersections through the public engagement process. However, it does have the second highest crash rate for the corridor, and there's some visibility issues, particularly with the way that the intersection is aligned at an acute angle rather than a 90-degree angle, which is desirable from a traffic perspective. The improvement strategies for this intersection are really just to improve visibility through signal backplates and lighting, and then potentially reconfiguring this intersection as a bigger, longer-term strategy to be a 90-degree angle, which is visualized for the next intersection to give you a sense of what that might look like. So Lower Creek Road is our next intersection. The third highest crash rate for the study corridor. We're following a pattern here. And this intersection we heard a lot about during the public engagement process. People felt that this was a really unsafe intersection, particularly for turning left onto Lower Creek Road from State Route 13. So we're looking at potentially signalizing this intersection, adding some dedicated turn lanes on State Route 13 to, again, move those vehicles turning away from the through traffic, reducing that conflict point. And then potentially, again, reconfiguring this intersection to a 90-degree intersection, which you can see in this concept plan here. And generally on this side of the corridor, the right-of-way is particularly wide, so some of these more drastic improvements may not require right-of-way acquisition, which would significantly reduce the cost. But again, they would all require additional engineering studies. So that brings us to what probably the second, if not first, most significant intersection in this corridor, which is the 366 intersection at NYSEG, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. It's got a crash rate twice as high as statewide facilities, and there's just a lot of access points along this section of the corridor, which creates a lot of points of conflict and confusion in terms of traffic patterns. So we're looking at adding additional turn lanes to deal with congestion during peak hours, potentially reconstructing this intersection as a roundabout. And then additionally, one of the recommendations we came up with was to move the Dryden, the NYSEG driveway to align with Pinckney Road, which would create a four-way intersection and reduce having two different access points within close proximity to each other. So that's just a conceptual diagram of that roundabout as well as an annotated photo of where the turn lanes might be. And then lastly, in terms of intersections, we looked at State Route 366 Main Street. This intersection had issues in the morning peak with people trying to get onto the corridor headed into Ithaca. And so we're looking at potentially signalizing this intersection, maybe creating an additional right turn lane on State Route 366 to kind of separate the turning movements, and also could reconfigure this intersection as a 90-degree angle. So those are our intersection improvements, and then I'll kind of quickly go through corridor-wide improvements. I know we're tight on time here. So in terms of multimodal improvements, we looked at the TCAT service currently does not stop along State Route 13 west of the 366 corridor, or 366 intersection, excuse me. And it has a flag stop service east of the corridor between there and the village of Dryden. So that means that riders can just flag down the bus wherever they are at along the corridor, which has its benefits. But we also looked at the potential of creating a designated stop service should development continue to occur along this corridor and more transit is out there. So we looked at the pros and cons of that. And then in terms of bike and bed accommodations, we really focused our efforts on the potential for a shared use path, again, west of the State Route 366 corridor, providing connections to all of the development activity within that section as well as to the Dryden Rail Trail. And this is just a quick conceptual diagram of what that might look like at Warren Road. This shared use path is to the left here on this image. Again, we created some access management strategies in terms of reducing conflict points along this corridor, which can have some significant benefits for any busy commuter corridor, and then also considering adopting those in the town and the village's zoning codes. Corridor expansion was brought up several times throughout the project process. Based on our traffic engineer's analysis, it's not seen as something that's necessarily required at this point within the 10-year planning horizon. And also it's a very costly improvement and would require a long time frame and a lot of money. You can see here that the Florida DOT estimates $2.5 million per mile to widen the rural arterial from 2 to 4 lanes. I can imagine that that would be even higher in New York State. And then we developed some cost estimates for each of the intersections as well as the corridor-wide improvements. You can see here that's a pretty hefty number, $17 million for all of it. So, again, some of these would be shorter term and lower cost, but just to give the county a sense of the magnitude of the improvements. And then we also included some implementation matrices at the end of the report, just identifying important players, potential funding sources, and timeframes. So with that, thank you very much. I know that was a heck of a lot of information in a short period of time, so I appreciate you all listening, and we are more than glad to take any questions at this point.
Thank you, Katie. Are there any questions? I can't see you all until Katie stops sharing her screen. I'm Mike Lean, and then Anna Kellis, and then Martha.
I just want to say thank you to Bart LeJudis and also to Katie Borghella and Fernando de Aragon for the efforts they put forward for this study. If it doesn't do anything else, it, as Katie said, raises our awareness that this is our lifeline in Tompkins County. We don't have a connection to the interstate highway system here. And so this is a federally aided highway, and in recognition of that. And this is where all the goods and materials come down from into Cornell University, for example. It's where the people travel and commute into Tompkins County from surrounding areas in Cortland and further north. And if we don't start thinking about it, we'll be overwhelmed sometime when there won't be any money available. So when money becomes available, we need to be advocates for the kind of improvements that they're talking about here, and maybe even more greater improvements depending on what the traffic situation improves, traffic situation expands to, I should say. And it may happen. We are at this point the one bright spot upstate of economic development, and I'm not seeing that stopping because we have our colleges and our universities. So thank you to our consultants for the work they've been doing.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for being a part of it.
Thank you. Anna.
Yeah, thank you so much. Super comprehensive. I have tons of questions.
Anna, we can't hear you well.
Is that any better?
Nope.
How about this? Is that any better?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I'm going to stick to just my two primary questions, and I can always follow up with Katie, I think, probably, or all of you. But I'm curious about state funding. This is, Route 13. It is a state highway, or it's not? I'm trying to, right, Katie?
Yes, it's a state highway, yes. Yeah.
Right, so how does that work, that we would, if we were interested in doing any capital improvements, is it the responsibility exclusive of the state? Is that something that could be done by local? What would we be eligible for? I know in intergovernmental committee that we just had Tiger. I'm trying to remember, Martha. There was the conversation about a new chair at the federal level and possible increased access or interest in capital improvements. So certainly this puts us in good standing because we have a study that shows the need for it and shows a design. But I'm just curious about funding.
Andrew. Well, I can start this and somebody else wants to add. It is a state road. The state has jurisdiction and responsibility. The state often will use state monies for a variety of projects. They also will, I can see them easily, in fact, almost assuredly, tapping into federal funds, federal highway funds, to do any larger proposal or project. The study, if you take time to read it, you see that there's some lower cost recommendations. Those could conceivably happen with state funding only and in a much quicker time frame. And of course, the larger projects, they will seek out federal funding. There is room for local participation. I don't think the state would ever say no, but I think the bulk of any project here would be state or federal funding.
So basically you put this in the meeting now to give me homework and work to do come January.
Sorry.
And Katie, I had one question for you
about our focus development areas. I agree with Mike. I think that this is, you know, this is our lifeline to the rest of the state with respect to commerce. But, you know, my one concern would be sprawl, promoting sprawl versus, you know, focus development areas developments, you know, an increasing maybe dependency and focus on cars rather than.
I mean, you're getting quiet again, so I don't know if you asked a question yet.
I did. I was wondering what Katie's perspective and also Fernando with respect to our focus development studies were. And although, you know, I definitely see this as our lifeline for interstate, you know, and intrastate commerce and economic development. How do we balance, and was that taken into consideration with respect to the recommendations of how to update this while not promoting sprawl?
Yeah, I think, you know, the land use aspects of this study did take a close look at how not to promote sprawl as part of this, the access management and some of the future growth scenarios and that type of thing. And I think there's wide recognition that any major improvements that are beyond, you know, backplates of the signals and that kind of thing will require a much more in-depth analysis. So, for instance, the intersection at NYSEG in that area, that would require a lot more analysis, and that we would definitely be looking at our development focus area that's considered in that area and what the implications might be for land use and traffic and make sure that that's designed correctly.
All right.
I just would hate to see us increasing our dependency on cars at this time, so thank you.
Well, I would say the more you can show multimodal activity along a corridor, the better, the more competitive you would be when it comes to funding allocation.
Wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Martha, and then Mike Sigler.
Well, thanks, Anna, for taking my first two questions, so I'll move on to the third. First, a concern really about the conflict between moving traffic faster and faster and the complete streets idea of actually going the opposite direction of trying not to slow traffic down, but to keep roads like this on a human scale, especially with respect, you know, pedestrians and bicyclists. And would certainly second the point about really redesigning the NYSEG intersection to try to create a new village. We've talked about that for years. A question, though, specifically about some of those intersections where you, I guess, Katie, you proposed 90-degree intersections like Hanshaw and Lower Creek. Why not a roundabout? You've got, I mean, it seems like in some of those areas you actually have plenty of space. Aren't roundabouts now seen as kind of the preferred strategy if the space exists?
There's certainly some data out there to suggest that they are more efficient and a better design solution. Obviously, it's context-specific, intersection to intersection. As I'm sure you're aware, roundabouts can be somewhat contentious in communities. So our idea was to create kind of a suite of recommendations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe the roundabout doesn't fly here in Tompkins County, but reconfiguring the intersection would still help with, you know, improving visibility and reducing conflict points and distances across the intersection.
Okay, and certainly helping with emissions as people don't have to slow down as much.
Yeah, and Martha, I would say just to add to that also that, you know, if any of these potential projects became the focus of a DOT federal aid process, you know, whether it be federal funding or state funding, there's always sort of a preliminary design process that you have to go through with the state to look at various alternatives. So the way they would use this report is to, you know, to go back and say, you know, what did these folks look at back in 2020? And then they would carry that further through some engineering design. And almost most of the intersections that we looked at, they would look at probably three or four different alternatives just for one intersection. So, you know, a stop control, if that's what exists today, would be looked at to continue that. Or more of a signalized intersection, in which case you would start to probably realign that a little bit, which is where the 90 degrees comes in. And then they would probably almost assuredly look at a roundabout as well. Again, just as part of the original preliminary design process, and then ultimately go, they agree on what would be the preferred alternative, and then you go through more of a final design to ultimately build it.
Great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, this study will not limit the evaluation that Keith is just describing in any way.
Thank you. Thanks, Martha. Mike Sigler?
Hi. So I'm from New Jersey, and just I'll only agree to a roundabout if you actually teach people who has the right of way in the roundabout.
Right. Well, right.
Teach people in class that. I don't know. But, yeah, I see the one in Elmira. It's nice. It's big. And then there's one in Newfield, too, that just went in. And then they put the ones down on 13, just past Alpine Junction. And then they put another one down there, too. So it's like four new ones in the course of my existence here. My big question, you had mentioned kind of reducing the number of access points along the roadway. And I'm just wondering why I know you're thinking about that for like NYSEG, for example. All right, the NYSEG property, they actually have an access point onto the one roadway. Do they really need an access point onto Route 13, was my thinking. Or then you have the access Lower Creek Road. I frankly have never really understood why that road is there. I mean, it's not like there's a bunch of people coming in off that road. You could literally block both sides and send people a different way and make Warren Road your bigger access point. So I'm just wondering why maybe did you look at that, or were those looked at and you said, no, those are a terrible idea, Sigler, we're not doing that. I don't know.
One of
those things.
Well, certainly access management, one of the access management strategies that we identified was moving, if possible, moving driveways and access points off of State Route 13 directly and onto secondary roads. So just for that same reason. In terms of closing Lower Creek Road, I don't think we considered that. I think that was a little out of the scope of the study. However, there is a recommendation to consider restricting turning movements there. So maybe people aren't allowed to turn left off of State Route 13 onto Lower Creek Road or vice versa, depending on what is identified in the traffic analysis.
Thank you, Katie. You are right there, Mike. You still want to get rid of Lower Creek Road? What other road you want us to just
get rid of the road? I don't really know. Really, you could drive just up to Warren and then get on 13 at Warren. I've never really understood why that road's there. Same thing with NYSEG. I don't really know why you have to pull off the highway to get NYSEG when you can pull over by Valero, the gas station, go into the NYSEG compound. It just seems like that's it's a dated entry point for that highway. So,
all right.
And that's about it. No, that was my big questions.
Your thoughts are definitely noted. Thank you. Ann Corman and then Shauna Black. And then let's move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to thank you for the presentation. My family's in Albany, so I go to Albany a lot, and over the years, roundabouts are aplenty there, and they keep the traffic moving. But the thing is, when you're going around in a circle, it's hard to look ahead plus around the circle, and if there's nobody in the traffic circle, it's very easy to kind of see through there. But if there's trucks, if there's an area that the more congested it is, the increasing difficulty, if not impossible, to see anywhere around that curve. And so what I found in the heavier congested areas, if people also use the roundabout, then it really makes it a lot more dangerous. So how is a person going to get through a roundabout? How is somebody with a physical disability that's going maybe a little slower, someone with a stroller, on a bicycle, etc.? So even though they keep the cars moving, I think it creates a disadvantage for for other people outside of cars. So, but I really liked the idea of the pathway where there was a green area in the middle of the road, because that would give people crossing the road a place to stop. And they don't have to cross the whole, all of the lanes at once. And also, if that created an area where people could safely, we were encouraging people to use the roads for walking, biking, you know, with that path down the middle of the road. So I liked that one the best. So I guess I didn't have a question, just comments. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I see the chat. We're already putting Anna to work. Sean LeBlanc.
Yeah, I also wanted to thank the people that were involved in this collective group. And I thought this study was actually very useful in us figuring out what is actually needed on Route 13. It was surprising to me to I went out for a bike ride a few weeks ago to see how many people are actually crossing Route 13 at Warren Road, and there's absolutely no bike lane. There's no pedestrian walkway, and it is actually quite dangerous. The reason why I think this study was so important, and also the reason why I think it was a very good investment of $200,000, was the fact that we have had people lose their lives in these intersections. The intersection of Lower Creek Road has been extremely dangerous, as well as on Warren Road, we've had loss of life too. So I'm glad that we're looking at this. We have some recommendations for the state, and hopefully we can see some remedy to counteract and provide some safe roadways. I also hope that, you know, in the future we could look at more bike paths and safer pedestrian walkways at Warren and along 13, because I think with the bike trails coming up, we're seeing more people that are coming from Dryden, that are coming from Warren Road, that are trying to bike downtown into, you know, the main part of our community. So thank you again, and I think this was a really good investment of our county funds.
Thank you, Shauna. Plenty of what I wanted to say, and thank all of you. Thank you, Katie, Katie, Fernando, everyone involved with this study as well. My least favorite intersection is Henshaw and 13, but I also, you know of a young Black man who lost his life at Warren and 13 in a very bad accident. So it certainly highlights things that we need to look at. And we know that it's just our first go at this, and as we think of where to next, you know, I'm sure we'll be developing and getting more ideas and different ways of making them safer. So thank you all again. Thank you for the presentation. I love visual, so it's great to have the words, but also just see the aerial view of what we're talking about. That helped me to focus, and I'm sure for people watching, it was very helpful as well. So thank you for doing that. Anything else before we move on?
Leslyn, I'd just like to say that it's really been a pleasure working with Katie and Keith and the whole team. They've been fabulous, and they've been very responsive to the steering committee, and just kudos to them for this job.
Thank you, Katie. Yeah. All right, thanks, folks. And have a good night. You're welcome to stay for the rest of our meeting if you'd like.
I'm going to go grab dinner. It's been a pleasure, though. Thank you, guys, really.
Thank you again.
Take care.
Take care, everybody.
Take care. All right. I don't have anything else to report. County Administrator, County Attorney, Finance Director. Pardon?
Appointment.
What did you say?
Appointment. Workforce Development Board.
Oh, shoot. I do have it. Sorry. I do have an appointment to make to the Carrie Whitmore to the Workforce Development Board. She's a TC3 representative. The term will expire June 30th of 2021. That's the only one?
Mm-hmm. Restaurant consent.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. County Administrator, County Attorney, and Finance Director. Jason, you're going first?
Yes.
Okay.
I think roundabouts solve the problem 24/7. I'm a big fan of roundabouts. Put a roundabout everywhere.
Oh, gosh.
I like roundabouts. All right.
We are thumbs down. I am not a roundabout fan.
I tell you what, I built
it in Canada. We know what you're saying.
I built a roundabout in Batavia, and it eliminated the safety risk. It took a graded D intersection to an A. It is the way to go. It will eliminate safety concerns. All right.
Jason, I think we're having trouble with your video.
Thanks, Ed. All right, I'm going to share my screen with you. Can everybody see this? This is the ever beloved COVID presentation that we do. Thanks to Dom, who puts it together for us, and all the folks that put effort into this. This is our biweekly or every legislator update. We'll go through quick, give you some download on what's been going on since the last legislative meeting. Increase of about 124 cases since the last time, 47 active cases now, total of 606 have recovered. Hospitalizations are at 5, but not all of those are Tompkins County residents. Since our last get-together in October, the governor announced the microcluster strategy and some guidance. They've also announced since then how schools can reopen in microcluster if they have a microcluster in an orange or red zone. We don't have that here. And hopefully we won't ever have that here. So right now that's not relevant to us, but it is relevant to some of the adjacent counties to us. There was an extension on residential evictions till the end of January 1. The Executive Order 72 was issued, which extends, amongst many things, remote meetings and mask requirements till December 3rd. And then there is clarification from DOH, Department of Health, on travel guidance, which provides an option for folks when traveling from a travel advisory state into New York, resident or otherwise, the ability to test out, so to speak, of the 14-day quarantine with a test prior to leaving and a test upon arrival. Internally, we've been doing some planning. We've called up about a total of 34 employees to support the health department with quarantine calls and tracing, which has been very helpful, and we greatly appreciate those departments that have allowed those staff to come in two-week rotations. ICSD went to some remote work till tomorrow, I believe. We also added a few extra staff up to the EOC to support some internal planning, some redundancy, and some vaccination prep in anticipation of a vaccination that will be distributed hopefully shortly. We also updated a directive internally around masks, and Ithaca College announced that it will be in person starting, I believe, in February, which is good to see. A series of publications or press releases are relating some exposures. We did another town hall. Thank you, Deborah. A lot of viewing since then. I think 500 plus. So we've had a lot of people taking a look at it, which is good. We're hoping to maybe do another one next week, at least the one before the Thanksgiving holiday. Seemed to get some good response, some good questions as well on the fly. OHR continues to do, human rights continue to do a panel discussion on a monthly basis. Had another good turnout for the Octobers. We'll have another one in November. We issued some guidance or some clarification yesterday or today on the new travel quarantine guidance for the public. And we also issued some internally to our own staff as we're getting questions internally about holiday travel and so on. This is our hours and leave and expense use. We added another section here, and that's unemployment payments. A little bit more than usual, probably double right now than what we've had before. And this is just unemployment related to the furloughs that we had. I expect that'll drop off going into the next quarter. But it is a COVID expense. This slide specifically, as well as the following slide, was sent to NYSAC, and Ryan Gregory and Steve Aquarius used some of our information when they spoke with Budget Director Mojica on Monday, and they wanted some of the middle-sized counties. So we sent this slide and this slide showing them some of the expenses for testing. So just to show you here, you know, about 900,000 of expenses, some of this will be reimbursable. We're starting to file those reimbursements outside of the testing. Unemployment, we will get some payback from that. That's yet to be determined as how the states or how some of that repayment is going to be received from the feds. And obviously, most of this is not reimbursed. This is regular pay. But this is time committed to the event. So here's a slide about community testing. I was misspoken at the last meeting. We do have extra capacity left in the original appropriation. So the legislature appropriated $300,000. And at that point in time, we were assuming probably anywhere between 750 to 1,500 tests per week. And in this case, as you can see, this column here are the tests per week. So in terms of the ones that we pay for. So it's while it's increased as of the past few weeks, it is still relatively about 500 on average. So it's below what we estimated. And our $300,000 appropriation is after FEMA reimbursement. So we may be floating at any point in time up to $750,000 of cost in anticipation of reimbursement coming in. But from the start to the end of the evolution, net, you've appropriated $300,000 of funding for testing. Right now, at this rate, if we take the average, and we're seeing an increase right now over the past several weeks because of the surge across the state, across the country, even if that sustains for a little bit, we think we still have probably another 15 weeks of testing capacity available in the original appropriation. So that was where I misspoke last week or 2 weeks ago about that. I want to clarify that. We think we're in a good position probably to bring us through January and probably into February till we have to talk about this again in terms of needing more appropriation. Obviously, if cases continue to grow in terms of, testing continues to grow like it has been the past few weeks, it'll be closer to the 15-week side, maybe a little bit less. But if they kind of level out to what we saw in the first 6 or 7 weeks, I'd expect it to maybe stretch a little bit longer in 15 weeks. So we have been filing reimbursement as quickly as CMC cashes their check and posts it, cashes our check and posts it. So we're filing those reimbursements. And from what our doer folks have shared with us, the first few filings are now in the final stages of review. So I think the first three or four weeks are in the final stages of review in FEMA. It would be great by the next meeting we have, I could tell you that we received our first reimbursement, but, hopefully before the December meeting, we'll have our first reimbursement or series of reimbursements. At that point, we'll be able to look at turnaround time, so on and so forth, and we'll probably be able to measure out a little bit better as to how long, this appropriation will last. So I think that's it. That's all I have. I don't know, Amy, Frank. You want to add anything?
No, we're good. Just happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great.
Okay, any questions? Dan, fine.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we can get any update on hiring nurses that are assisting with the contact tracing effort.
Yeah, sure, Frank.
Yeah, good news on that front. We have two folks that will be starting just after the Thanksgiving holiday, and I think we have the third person lined up now, so we'll be figuring out how quickly they can get started. So by the beginning of December, we should have those three nurses on board.
Very good. Thank you.
Dan, Martha Robertson, followed by Ann Corman.
On the FEMA reimbursement, any idea if the state would pick up the 12.5%? That was one of the lines on your document.
I haven't heard anything. I asked the last time we spoke about it, and crickets on that end.
Because we understand from Ryan Gregoire at NYSAC that they are looking at spending some of their money down. So.
Yeah, they are. My takeaway from speaking with Ryan as well is that it's going to be for their needs, not for ours. But we have not heard anything about that. Obviously, it would be great if we did. It'll extend our appropriation even further. But right now, I haven't heard anything.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right. Ann Corman?
Thank you. I was wondering if we know what's driving the, as far as the COVID tests, the number up, because before we were looking at 300 and something, and now it's up over 800 and something, so that's more than double. Just have any idea?
I think it's just a, I think it's just an increase in testing and probably an increase in case awareness across the state and the country. But Frank, I don't know if you're, you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of components. I think the case is rising around us. There's still you know, quite a few folks that are live here but may work outside of the county and have exposure points. We're seeing children related to return to school criteria coming through as well. And we're seeing symptomatic folks. I think, you know, we're coming into the winter season and the weather is changing and we're closing our windows. So we're seeing folks that are symptomatic coming through as well. So it's kind of a combination of all of those things. If I had to tell you the biggest driver, I think it's because of all of the increase in cases, particularly around us, driving people to seek testing.
Thank you. And I appreciate the information session that Deborah and Frank and Amy and Jason did for the community. I think the more information out, the better. And I've been seeing a number of people, you know, a steady amount of people in the hospital. So my thoughts and prayers are with them and their family. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Deborah, then Henry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious to know if somebody comes in for testing and they're having symptoms, given that it could be the flu, it could be COVID, it turns out that it's not COVID. Is that considered a medically necessary test or do we have to pay for it?
No, if they have symptoms, it is considered medically necessary, whether it turns out positive or not.
Thank you.
Nice and concise question, Deborah. Henry.
Yes. Frank, do we know whether the people who are not tested for free are also going up?
I'd have to look at the slide. It does have the total tested versus Tompkins County, so it is in that slide that Jason shared. Dominic's telling me he thinks it about doubles.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do know there are a lot of folks coming from surrounding areas to use the testing site here.
Okay. I know Jason talked about this morning, but can you address the downtown testing facility again?
Yes, we're working with Cuyahoga Health Systems. We're hopeful that by the end of the month, we'll have something operational. We're close and putting some of the finishing touches on getting that open and operational with them. So hopefully by the end of the month.
And I heard that will be inside. That won't be outside?
Correct. Correct. It will be an inside location.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, it's harder to do a large drive-through downtown, and so when we were trying to evaluate what made the most sense, setting up something indoors, not only for traffic and those kind of issues, but also the weather elements, it's going to be challenging at the mall this winter, so it made sense to look at an indoor location.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Shauna Black and Jason, if you don't mind, stop sharing your screen. I can't see folks. Shauna Black?
Hi, thanks, Jason and Frank. I was wondering, can you walk us through if someone goes on the website and schedules an appointment, how is it determined if they are eligible for the county picking up their testing amount versus if they're not insured versus if they're insured? How are we actually tracking that, or how is CUGA Med tracking that?
Yeah, so when you register, there's a series of questions you have to answer that ultimately get to that final decision point on who the payer is. So you're asked if you have symptoms, it asks if you are a close contact, and then it moves into your insurance collection information, and then it also asks, it knows what your address is, obviously, because you're putting an address in, and that ultimately is what makes the determination, and then I believe Amy gets a spreadsheet from the hospital with the breakdowns each week.
Okay, so people that are coming in from other counties are being billed directly from the hospital?
Correct. If they don't have insurance and they don't meet criteria to fall under your program, they are being billed by the hospital.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the report, as always.
The only other thing I want to add to the report has nothing to do with this, is that if you haven't seen your NISAC publication yet, you should check it out on page 36, because there's an article by Dominic in the NISAC publication about the community testing. So I'll send it out in my updates tonight in case you haven't seen it yet, but it's in your inboxes if you get the publication. Dom did a great job with it.
Did you say an article by Dominic or an article about Dominic?
By Dominic about the community testing.
Oh, cool. I'd love to see that. That's wonderful.
I'll send it out to everybody with the updates tonight.
All right, Tompkins County, check us out. Go ahead with your best of Dominic. And that's all up on the map. Okay. Anything else from you, Jason? No?
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
Jonathan, anything from you?
No.
All right. Rick, finance director.
Hello, good evening.
Evening.
I'm going to share a screen with you. Are you seeing it?
Yes, sir.
Very good. We have three items tonight to share with you on the finance director's report. I sent you an email with these attachments, but I also have it here on the screen for you. The first section is a short report on our casino revenues. As you know, we stopped receiving casino revenues for the second quarter of this year, and surprisingly, we got a check just recently for both casinos that adds up to $82,681 for the third quarter. So that brings us to a year-to-date total of about $500,000 compared to our budget, which is $1.5 million. So we're down 84.2% compared to last year, obviously. And the year-to-date cash receipts are down $1,047,000, or down 67.6%. So I just thought I'd give you the last 3 years in our current year so you can see how we were trending compared to the prior years. Again, our operating budget for this year for casino revenue was a little over $1.5 million. So coming in at just $500,000, we're only at a third of what our budget was. I'm not sure what Jason projected when he did our cutbacks in revenues. I believe he did cut back casino revenue at least $1 million. Is that correct, Jason? Is that close?
I think that's about it, Rick.
Yeah. So with the analysis that county administration has done, we're right about where we projected about 3 or 4 months ago where we would be with casino revenues. But we do have the fourth quarter to go, and hopefully and maybe surprisingly, we should have some better figures there for the fourth quarter, depending on how the economy does and how COVID treats us. The second part of my report is what I call the contingency fund report. This section here shows that we started off with $900,000 in our general contingency allocation. We have used all that money. We just finished recording the last budget adjustment for the year. About 2 days ago, we've spent year-to-date $1,017,000. That means we're in the hole right now, having spent more of our contingency funds than we have allocated or budgeted. So we're down about $118,000, for contingency. The question then, becomes, what do we do about this? And I suggested to Jason that, well, for part A of this exercise, we have to fund this $118,000 deficit, which means we'll bring a resolution to the legislature that asks for you to appropriate a portion of your fund balance and put it into council contingency here to bring this $118,000 up to even, because we've actually spent a little more contingency funding than what we planned. The second part, or part B, that we have to answer is how much more of contingency funding might we need to get through to the end of the fiscal year. And I brought this up with Jason today, and we haven't settled on a final figure, but it's going to be about $200,000. If there's some other big things that are looming out there that we know about, we might have to add that to the council contingency amount. The things that hurt us the most in this list, and I'm not going to read each one, is there were quite a few big terminal pays that the departments asked to get reimbursed. We had an unusual number of terminations as a result of COVID-19 and people retiring. And so the other big one was this $300,000 for the Cayuga Health System community COVID testing, which we have just finished talking about. And it's not unusual for us in any given year to be $200,000 over on our contingency plan and how much money we might use, which means we'd have $200,000 left over at the end of the year. But it's also not unusual to go $200,000 or $300,000 above what we projected in our contingency funding. Unfortunately, and as I talked with Jason today, we'd like to know about this sooner rather than later. And it is a little disquieting to bring you information that we've all actually overshot our contingency fund planning by $118,000. It would be nice to know about that as it's happening or before it happens. Jason has remarked that we want to do some policy upgrading to ensure the fact going into the future that departments are not going forward with resolutions to the legislature to use any contingency funds unless he and I have both reviewed it and have specifically authorized it to go forward. So once again, this just brings you up to date on the contingency funds and what's been used so far. We should be bringing you a resolution that will cover this deficit before the end of this calendar year. It'll also have an additional amount, probably to the tune of $200,000 or so, to seek additional funding. Are there any questions about this section of my report?
Yes, Mike Lean.
Rick or Jason, what are you projecting in the next 60 days that we've got to pay out a contingency?
That's something I think Rick and I have to talk a little bit more about, Mike. I think probably the biggest thing we'll want to know is terminal pays that are going to be as a result of retirements, and that's probably a question we'll shoot out to department heads to get some feedback as to are they going to expect an increase in terminal pay that's a result of some retirements that hasn't yet come forward. That's probably the biggest thing off the top of my head, Rick, that I could foresee.
Yeah, if you look back in years where we've used a lot of contingency fund in the last 2 or 3 months, we also keep using the contingency fund to help balance budgets well into January of the new year, because a lot of times bills are paid at the very end of the year and we don't know something is going to run a department's budget way out of whack until sometimes mid or even the end of January. So frequently in the past, you have seen money being asked for out of the contingency fund well into January, sometimes even February of the new year. But my estimate at this time, barring any really big items that I don't know about, we usually spend about $100,000 to $150,000 in those last 2 months of the year.
All right.
Anything else on contingency fund?
I don't know if it's contingency fund, but I have hands up. So Deborah, Martha, Henry.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. I'm trying to figure out, we've been hearing all year from you and Jason that we're going to have to use megabucks out of our general fund or fund balance to make up for our operating deficit this year. So is this couple hundred thousand dollars? I mean, that's just a piece of that, isn't it? Why are you so distressed that we shot the contingency fund?
Well, okay, there's two parts of why you could run into a deficit at the end of the year. There's revenues that come in short. There's expenditures which come in over. This piece of the pie just addresses those departments that expenditure budgets run over. So contingency fund is supposed to take care of unforeseen expenditure items that might hit their budget that were either unanticipated or under budgeted for one reason or another. So that's just one half of the pie, looking at the expenditure side. When revenues come in short, such as state revenues coming in short or sales tax coming in, that doesn't have anything to do with your contingency fund because that's only for expenditure-related items. When you have revenues coming short, it directly hits your fund balance. So when if we have, for example, $40 million budgeted in sales tax and we only get $30 million, that means your revenues fell short by $10 million, and the impact of that $10 million deficit hits fund balance directly.
But in the long run, it's all coming out of fund balance.
True.
Okay.
So when you see this resolution coming forward at the end of the year, giving some more money into the contingency fund, the other side of that budget adjustment will be a reduction of general fund balance.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Deborah. Thanks, Rick. Martha?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I mean, a couple of things are really COVID-related. The $300,000 for testing, the Rheonics, $55,000. And if you're seeing more terminal pays than usual, that's money that we expect to spend. It's just not usually clustered into, one chunk, 1 year. Because we did an early retirement program, we had a bunch all at once, right? So that, this isn't scary stuff. It's all related.
It's pretty normal. Whenever you see something marked terminal pay or disability pay, those are pretty normal things that we see each and every year. You just might see a few more in this particular fiscal year than in the usual fiscal year.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the two outliers are your STEP program expansion and your COVID testing. I mean, without those, you would be just about 500, you'd have 475 more back in there. I mean, those are really outliers, and they're big outliers, meaning you normally wouldn't, even if you had an outlier in a year, you normally wouldn't have anything that big. I guess it's just concerning that we've hit that mark. You don't ever want to exceed your contingency. I think it's explainable and it's understandable because we've invested in the STEP program, we invested in community testing. All understandable. Obviously, we just don't ever want to exceed our contingency if we don't have to. The measures that Rick and I talked about are just ensuring that we're having folks. A lot of times we don't see the contingency request till they're on the committee agenda, and I think that needs to go through us to make sure we're aware of it. The second piece I talked to Rick about doing is also on the resolution that you approve is actually posting what the remaining balance in the contingent fund will be. And I think that will just help keep everything in check from that perspective so that we're all up to date as, all right, well, when we do this, we know we have 750,000 left or we have 50,000 left. I think that's probably just an easy thing we can make to ensure that everybody, the full disclosure about where we are in the use of the allocation of the contingency fund. So,
can you remind me, does that 175 from STEP, is that in our target for 2021?
No, that was one time. That was not a target increase.
Okay. And then sheriff's replacement pay, 7 employees. I remember that coming through, but that seems like what's replacement pay?
I believe that's folks on 207C disability. and I think one or two of them have since received a retirement disability. But generally, I think the county is accustomed to replenishing the individual budget lines with disability payments in those instances. So
right,
I think on patrol and maybe three or four corrections. But we've done a fairly good job of moving those folks along. It's just it adds up.
Okay. Thanks very much.
All right, Henry.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Yes, Jason. If the state does not pay or reimburses entirely for Code Blue, would that come out of this fund too?
If the state does not reimburse fully for Code Blue, probably not. It would probably be a revenue shortfall because the way Code Blue works, that specific program is we expend the funding and then submit for reimbursement. And my guess is you would only get X back. You wouldn't get the whole thing back. So that would be what we would call a receivable shortfall. Actually, it would be a receivable shortfall. So it would be around the revenue side of things. Which is a unique challenge. I don't think we've had as much in the past, Rick, where when we invoice for revenue and we don't get the full amount, it creates an interesting accounting challenge on our end. But that's an internal issue.
Right.
And also, does this information make you want to raise a contingent fund for the next year's budget?
My primary reason for raising the contingent fund in next year's budget was for the combination of increased expenses, which at the end of the day, as Deborah pointed out, whether it's a shortfall in revenue or whether it's an increase in expense, it's all coming from the same pot. So increasing the contingent fund into the contingent line increases your levy base, which is really what's ultimately going to be needed to backfill either the increased expense or shortfall in revenue.
So you think $2 million is enough, or should it be 2.5?
Well, I think it should be bigger, but keep in mind, you've by utilizing fund balance to offset your levy, you've somewhat neutralized the benefit of increasing the contingent fund because you're not using levy money to support it. You're not creating a higher levy base. So you're essentially funding that increased contingency with fund balance. So next year, if we do lose a lot of revenue, when we're looking into 2022, you're going to have to make up more ground in terms of increasing your levy or cutting future expenses to balance the budget.
Thanks, Henry. I have a quick question on contingency. This is just curiosity. How does an employee end up with $30,000 of terminal pay? I mean, the Cliff Notes explanation.
So employees are entitled to carry over up to and cash out up to 3 years equivalent of vacation. So they get that paid out. And depending on their collective bargaining agreement, they may get additional payout for compensatory time. So if you have a tenured employee that has worked for the county for over 30 years, 3 years equivalent of vacation, depending on the collective bargaining agreement, could equal 12 weeks. 4 weeks a year they get a vacation times 3 years would be 12 weeks of vacation times their hourly rate at the time of retirement. Could be a hefty check. Lisa, am I missing anything on that?
Plus personal leave days that they haven't been used, plus floating holiday if they haven't used that. So it all adds up.
They could accrue up to 12 personal leave days, I think.
Yeah.
Right. And the higher the rate of pay, of course, if it's a director, as it is in this particular case, if it's a director at a higher rate of pay than the average employee, it obviously is going to affect the final payout.
Plus, we have fringe to that as well.
Plus fringe, right.
Oh, that's fringe, too.
Okay,
right.
Now that makes sense. Thank you. Now, something wasn't adding up. Okay, thank you. At some point, I may pitch you up for Lisa for a more in-depth tutorial. But thank you. Martha.
What do you mean you add fringe to it?
You have to pay Social Security, you have to pay retirement, you have to pay all those things on any payout. So you add a fringe calculation to it. So it's not 37,000 isn't what the individual pocketed. It's probably
two-thirds of that.
Probably two-thirds of that, yeah.
Yeah, because about two-thirds of it is the actual payout, and then our fringe rate is approximately 50%, so that makes up the other third.
Yeah, but our fringe rate includes health insurance. You're not paying health insurance for days that didn't
work.
You do
and you don't. In the Tompkins County model of fringe rate calculation, we use a formula that's based on all wages paid, and that's part of Kevin's fringe fund calculation worksheet in the budget. And the answer to your question, do we actually pay health insurance out for that employee? No, we don't. Not for, you know, that is a true statement. We don't have to pay health insurance on those wages for that employee. But as part of our calculation, that's whether it's 48% in 1 year or 52% in another year, that's based on all wages paid by the county in any fiscal year. And that's just part of the fringe fund way of allocating fringes across all departments.
Okay. Thank you. Sounds like a good topic for folks to get some education around. All right, next, Rick, go ahead.
I tried to keep this next one short, but it got a little wordy, so I won't read everything on here. You can read this before you go to sleep tonight. The room tax report that's been requested a couple of times since the last room tax report basically comes from the hand of Lisa Schott, our treasury manager, and Nick Helmholt over in the planning department. They are the ones that work together to devise this report. So if you find anything wrong with it, you can't blame me. No, if you find anything wrong with it, we'll look into it. But the top part of the report shows you in the first two columns our total room tax for the first three quarters compared to last year. So you see in quarter three, our room tax was up to $995,000. I'm reading it wrong way. $462,000 compared to $995,000 the previous year. We still have fourth quarter to go yet. And here you can see the year to date. For 2020, our year to date is $804,000 compared to almost $3 million last year. So you can figure out what percentage we're at for the year on your own. The two right-hand columns over here simply break those same numbers down into the hotel portion, which there are only 27 registered hotels and motels is the first two columns. And the final two columns is all our B&Bs or bed and breakfasts. Lisa Shaw has provided a little bit of detail here on, well, how many of these entities do we actually have? Total registered lodging establishments, 141. Of that 141, there are 27 hotels, motels. There are 114 registered bed and breakfast. Now, when we see registered, those are ones that we have on our books that pay directly to us all the time or some of the time. There are a whole bunch more that pay us through Airbnb, and they're not part of our books as far as knowing who's sending us money. But this is how many that we receive directly from. Delinquent hotels and motels. This is a question that comes up from Henry and people on the planning board and some of the people that are following the planning side of the tourism dollars and things like that. As of right now, it's pretty much been the same the second and third quarter. Delinquent hotels and motels, we only have four, and I have some highlights of those four below. Delinquent bed and breakfasts, out of all 114, there's only 16. Now, as we move down here, here are some footnotes to the hotels, those four that have been delinquent. All hotels except three are current in the room tax returns and payments. Two hotels are the same ones that have been late in previous years and have nothing to do with coronavirus. The third hotel sent in the return but no payment, and the payment's expected to arrive sometime this month in November. and then it gives a few more stats here on the breakdown of those three or four delinquent hotels. Bed and breakfasts are highlighted down here. There were three that were late, sending in their third quarter return and their third quarter payment, and there were 13 that haven't sent in the returns for the entire year. Treasury staff's reaching out to all 13 of those, and they do that by email and telephone. We've communicated some of this information on delinquent hotels because Josh Freeman and Kelly Cartmill, the Strategic Tourism Planning Board, or STP, have been sending us emails asking or complaining about the delinquent hotel tax returns and what are we doing about it. We did some research and we communicated back through Nick Helmholtz how we were making significant progress in reining in the delinquent hotel tax payments. As you can see, there were only four delinquent hotels in this last quarter, and two of these four had significant payment delay issues even before coronavirus or COVID. You can see here that the third quarter, the finance department collected $165,185 in room tax revenue for properties which had been delinquent earlier in this fiscal year. To put it into perspective, approximately 19% of the total room tax collected through the third quarter, and it's double the amount of late room taxes collected in 2019. So we're catching up on a lot of the delinquencies. The only other thing I haven't addressed in this report is the question about what do we do when they're late. We're doing the same thing in the third quarter and the fourth quarter what we did in the second quarter. We're writing a letter that my staff and Jonathan at the county attorney's office sends to these delinquent taxpayers. That first letter usually gets their attention, and it usually gets them to pay. There's only been, like you can see from this report, only a couple that haven't responded to that letter. After that, they get a second letter that's a little bit stricter and a little bit more formal. And, you know, that, again, pretty much gets them to pay. I still think that there's a lot of apprehension with the hotel taxpayers in that some of them are still not running a very vibrant business, and some of them are hardly open at all. And it's really hard to squeeze them in this economic crisis. And even though there's a lot of pressure upon all taxpayers to pay their taxes, and of course these taxpayers must pay their taxes too, we found that if we're willing to work with them and they're willing to work with us, most of them will finally come and make up the money that they owe us. So I hope you will read this in its entirety and fully to get an understanding. It's a lot more work for our staff this year than in previous years because we have to reach out and be more communicative with the hotel taxpayers than ever before, and it does take a lot of time and a lot of effort. So I'll answer any questions that you might have on this particular topic.
Thank you very much, Rick. Thank you for the report. Mike Lane.
Something that we've talked about before, but I would certainly like to see us in some way require the taxpayers in this situation to segregate the tax once they received it into an escrow account rather than to use it for their operating expenses and just pay it as a lump sum. I don't know whether any place else out there does that kind of thing, whether it takes state legislation, whether it makes any sense or not, but it's come up in discussion over the years several times with the delinquencies because they collect the money and they have it. But they're spending it on something else. Mm.
Thanks, Mike. Good thought. Anything else, Rick? All right. Thank you very much, Rick.
Much
appreciate the full report.
Thank you.
I'll let you stop sharing your screen so I can see the lovely faces of all the other legislators. It is now 7:45. We are going to take a quick break.
How do I stop sharing here, Drew?
Because we haven't had a chance, so while Rick is doing that, how about we take a 10-minute break? And actually, why don't we just be back here at 8 o'clock? All righty, are we back?
We're back.
Do I have a quorum? I think I do. All right, let's move through this agenda. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Nope. All right, let's go to the consent agenda. The consent agenda are resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group, unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. Advisory board appointments. What am I missing, Kathy?
You start with the housing committee.
Oh, there it is. I was looking for my paper. Advisory board appointments, Housing and Economic Development Committee, Strategic Tourism Planning Board, Wendy Cobbler, Ithaca College Representative, term expires December 31 of 2021, Arthur Keith, Lodging Representative, term expires December 31st of 2022, to the TCAD Board of Directors, our very own former legislator Frank Proto, Tompkins County Representative, term expires December 31, 2023. To the Public Safety Committee, Emergency Response and Oversight Committee, no set terms. We have Brian Robeson, Director of Emergency Response Representative, John Halachek, Jr., Tompkins County Communications Center Manager Representative, Greg Potter, Tompkins County Information Technology Services Director Representative, David Amaro, City of Ithaca Police Department Representative, Jerry Wright, Village Police Chief Representative, Chris Jordan, Volunteer Firefighter Representative, Mark Conrad, Campus Police Rep, and Matt Van Houten, District Attorney. Those are all the appointments. And on to the resolutions. On the Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Resolution A, resolution authorizing a public hearing in accordance with Section 147F of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, as amended, ID 9610. Government Operations Committee, Resolution B, appointment of Election Commissioner for 2021-2022, ID 9619. And I'm assuming that this went through committee today, Amanda, and it's all good, yes. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Resolution C, rent forgiveness for tenants in the Tompkins Center for History and Culture, ID 9682. And Public Safety Committee, Resolution D.
I'd like to pull that one.
Pulled by Dan Klein. May I have someone move the consent agenda and appointments? Moved by Anna Callis, seconded by Shauna Black. All in favor of the consent agenda. Vote.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Jones?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Portman?
Yes.
Mike Blaine?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Clairvoy?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much, and thank you for letting us hear your beautiful voices in the roll call vote. Moving on to standing and special committee reports. Keep them brief. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
We have not met since our last meeting. Our upcoming meeting will be the 16th of November, and we will have a special presentation by St. John's, who's providing our shelter service, and they'll also be updating us on Code Blue.
Thank you very much, Donna.
Thank you.
Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We have not met since our last legislature meeting. You heard the report tonight on the Route 13 study. That was something we had discussed, and we really wanted to bring forward to the full legislature. We'll be meeting again. I forgot what day we're meeting. Kathy doesn't remember yet.
I don't remember,
but you'll all get your we'll all get notice of that. Thanks. A couple weeks.
November 19th.
Thank you, Dan.
Rescued by Dan Klein, November 19th. At what time, Dan?
9 o'clock.
9 a.m. Thank you. Thanks, Mike. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Leslyn. We actually met today, just mere hours ago. And so there's a couple things I want to share with folks. One of the things that we talked about was legislator salaries for 2022 through 2026. And we had brief discussion, and we did pass the resolution that Mike Lane had offered, which keeps legislators' salaries what they are currently for the next 2 years, and then after that raises it 3%, and then the following year another 3%. So folks felt pretty good about that. There wasn't a lot of – there was actually no controversy, so that was nice. So I assume that will come to the full legislature at our next meeting, and if people have other proposals at that time or other opinions, you can certainly bring it forward then. Let's see. Okay, so we also passed two resolutions. We are going to have a public hearing to change the charter. When we changed our rules of the legislature a couple months ago for the organizational meeting portion of the rules, there was a few inconsistencies with what we changed it to with the charter. So we worked with Jonathan and Kathy, and there's just a few sentences that need to be changed. One thing in particular is to just say that just to refer back to the rules and kind of take some of all the specifics out of the charter. So that also will be coming forward, I assume, at the next meeting. And if folks have questions about it at that time, you can certainly ask me. We just want the charter to reflect what we passed as a legislature. And then the last thing I wanted to share is that we began to talk about, we're still going through the rules of the legislature. We began to talk about rule number 4, which is, which discusses the order of business of our legislature meetings. And we had, you know, lots of small changes again and commas and wording changes, which you'll see when this eventually comes to the full legislature. But I wanted to throw a couple things out there that people were talking about. And I'm not encouraging a discussion right now, but I want people to think about this because it will be something that we discuss at a future meeting. So there has been a proposal to reorder the business a little bit and move legislator privilege of the floor and reports from county administrator, county attorney, and director of finance to the end of the meeting. This was not agreed on by all of GO by any means. It was put forward by a couple of folks, and with the thinking that, you know, we reorder the agenda. The chair often reorders the agenda anyway, and these are some things that, you know, we often tend to do at the end because we want to get resolutions and staff items out of the way so the staff can go home. So it's a proposal. there will be lots of opinions about it. We had plenty of those opinions already today, but I just want to give everyone a heads up that that's something to think about. We didn't pass any resolution today on this in GO. We will hopefully be doing that at the next meeting. And then, again, eventually it will come to the full legislature. So I think that's it. Trying to be brief. I'm happy to take questions, but, again, I wasn't encouraging a discussion about those items right now. And the next meeting will be at the beginning of December.
Thank you, Amanda. GO has definitely been busy. I think it's important for us to acknowledge that one of the things around legislature salaries that next year is an election year for legislators. All seats are up as the legislature all gets elected all at the same time. We're not staggered. And one of the things we try to do is advertise what the salary will be ahead of time in case people are interested in running. They know what it is. Just in full transparency, we do that. So hopefully there'll be a resolution coming to, like you said, Amanda, to the full legislature, and then we'll have it. And by December, people will know if they want to make up their minds, if it's worth their time to do this. Some people do it for the love of doing it, not for the money. Thank you for taking that up. And I'm sure there'll be very spirited discussions about the reordering of business. Any other questions for Amanda or comments? All right. Thank you, Amanda. NGO. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. PAIC has not met since our last legislature meeting. In fact, we had nothing pressing on our agenda for so we didn't have a meeting. However, we will functionally have two meetings this month. We will be sitting in on HED's November 17th meeting, at which the case board subgroup that's been working on green workforce development will be presenting its report jointly to PEAK and HED. And then we will have our usual PEAK meeting on the Monday before Thanksgiving.
All right. Thank you, Deborah. Any questions for Deborah? Wonderful. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee meeting, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Hello. Thank you, Leslie. Our next meeting is this coming Monday, the 9th at 3 o'clock. We have a lot of kind of boilerplate resolutions on the agenda. We also have your direct report evaluations. Well, it's not just yours. It's direct report evaluations of Kathy and Jonathan that we're doing this year. And Laura Granger has been very kind to get those materials to us. They are in binders for you to pick up in Kathy Cobert's office. You have an email to that effect in your inboxes. So the three of you who are sitting in the chambers, before you leave, try to remember to go pick up your binders from Kathy's office. And we will have an executive session at the end of BCP on what? You got it? Okay. We'll have an executive session to start to discuss those evaluations at the end of BCP. And there's a lot of business, so make sure you have time to read your 105 pages for Monday. So that's it.
Yes, Dan, go ahead.
I have a budget question. It might be a Jason question, but it's a budget question. I don't think we've seen an updated estimate for the 2020 budget shortfall in a while. I'm wondering when we might see it. An updated version.
Good question.
That's a decent question.
We're going to be issuing some guidance to department heads on Monday for them to complete some year-end projections, and then from there we'll take that information in. I hope to have something ready probably by the end of the month to give you an understanding of where we think the shortfall is going to be.
Do you think it's possible to get it before we vote on the budget, or is that just not possible?
I don't think so right now, Dan. I tried to back into some numbers, but there's so many moving parts right now. What I want to do is basically I'm going to be giving all the department heads a spreadsheet of their actual budgets and have them project what their year-end expenses will be. It's very difficult right now without going through this process to know what state aid is going to be or what state aid is being withheld. We're gonna have them complete spreadsheets of the revenues expense lines essentially and project out to the end of December so we can get an understanding of it. I'm sorry I don't have anything more robust, more accurate to share with you right now, but I should have something within a few weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Good question, Dan. Thank you, Jason. We'll look for it. Any other questions to Martha or anything else to Martha? All right, get ready Monday. 100 plus pages. All right. Thanks, Martha. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Ann Corman, Chair.
Thank you. Buttercup and I stepped in the legislature recently, and there wasn't really much that got broken that a little epoxy can't fix. So we met, at least that's, hold on a second, but. Okay, Buttercup issue. So Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, we met on October 28th, and we discussed the proclamation that you heard Leslin read, and I was very glad that Sam George could attend today. Probably at some point later, Mike Lane maybe will give more information, or we can have Carol Kamen do it. But there are plaques going up around the community also honoring our American Indian heritage. The Office of Human Rights, Dr. Clark, he talked about his panel discussion that was coming up, and that was on the 29th of October. That was on compassionate mental health and social services. And if you didn't catch that, that's available on our YouTube channel, the Tompkins County YouTube channel. That was very well done. And I learned quite a lot about the services that we're doing. And people talk very frankly about, some of the struggles that people are having in the community. And we also talked just briefly on an update to our diversity statement, and Deanna Carithers, our Chief Equity and Diversity Officer, is going to help us work on that. And she also spoke about police reform, as she's going to be taking part of the lead with that, so she gave us an update. And I think, me and I think other folks in our committee were happy to hear that there's going to be even more involvement in the community, more input in the community in that. And I'm not saying that there wasn't going to be. What I mean to say is that that's the stage that's coming up next. And so we were glad to hear about that. And then our next meeting, we're combining our November and December meetings because our meetings fall at the end of the month, which is right around a lot of holidays for November and December. So our next meeting will be the first week in December, and we're still selecting that meeting date and time. And that's all I have. One last thing that was very important, actually. There's it was brought up, too, that in the community there's been a lot of anti-Semitic hate speech, harassment, and vandalism in and around, mostly centered in around the city of Ithaca. And I just wanted to say that that is very disconcerting for me to hear. And I definitely don't condone those behaviors. And I'm very glad that people are supporting the people who have been targeted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Any questions for Ann? Okay. Moving on. Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. We met yesterday, so it's easy for me to remember what we did. We had a great presentation by Ryan Gregoire legislative director at NYSAC. He gave us a full rundown of where they see things with the state budget. And he and other staff and Stephen Aquaria had met with Robert Mujica, the budget division director, a few weeks earlier. And he said it's the first time NYSAC has actually done that in the fall, which is really the right time to do it because that's when the governor is working on the executive is working on their budget. And he sent us along a document that I believe I sent it to all legislators. It's called County Recommendations for Overcoming the Current State Local Budget Crisis. And it's a 10-page document of things that they're suggesting to the governor's office. If I didn't send that to everybody, I will do that. So let me know if you didn't get it. Very helpful conversation and document. We spent some time talking about committee structure in the state assembly and legislate and the Senate. And Deborah suggested that all of us take on one committee and sort of dive into like what kind of work do they do, who's their chair, and think about what issues we might want to really try to push with that committee. So I think we're going to try to work towards a strategy for January and February, whether this committee continues or not. And finally, we had a Diana Miller from Cornell gave us some of her time to updating us on Washington, which nobody knows what the update is, but it was a good conversation. And finally, we passed a resolution, not unanimously, but did pass a resolution urging New York State to consider there are a variety of proposals for raising taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. And we didn't pick any one, but we did sort of make the case, try to urge the state government to consider that as they go forward with the next budget and trying to spread the pain, so to speak. Our next meeting is December 2nd. And our new assemblywoman will be talking to us about her top several goals for her first term in the legislature. And we're looking forward to that. And we're going to practice our lobbying on her. So
I'm familiar.
I know.
Got your
number. Yeah. You know where you live.
Thank you, Martha. Any questions to Martha? Yes, Michaeline.
Not really a question, but I really want to say that I'm really glad we formed this committee. You formed the committee, Leslyn, and with Martha. And I think seven of us on there now. To the other seven on the legislature, tune in sometime. It is so educational dealing with these people who are in Albany and Washington. Martha does an incredible amount of foundation work to get to a meeting by simply arranging for these folks to be with us and other things. In our minutes this time, we got a list of all the committees at the state legislature. And if others haven't seen that, that's something to look at. So right. I want to say I hope this committee continues. It's a real good thing, and I think the people we talk with appreciate the fact that they're getting feedback from the folks down the line.
Thank you so much, Mike. That's very nice. Yeah, the committee structure is astounding. It's like For the assembly, there are 37 standing committees, 40 subcommittees, 13 legislative commissions, and 19 task forces. So that's just one. But I just want to mention also that I think it has turned into a great conversation with these people who we've been able to get to join us so that we're really lobbying them every time they come and talk. And it's, you know, we're directly feeding into the way they think about the issues that affect us. So I really appreciate everybody being so engaged in the discussions. And yeah, thanks for setting up the committee, Leslyn. It's been great.
Well, somewhere in my crystal ball, I knew that COVID was going to happen. and we were not going to be able to go lobbying live. I don't know. So, but thank you to the others, Mike Sigler, Shauna Black, others who had some input in, you know, we should do something. So it wasn't just me. I wish I could take all the credit, but no, I can't. A quick question, Martha. There were some resolutions that we had sent to NYSAC when they were collecting resolutions, the committee conference, things that were going to go forward to the governor's office and on other places. Has there been any feedback on any of them when you all spoke with? Go ahead.
Yeah. I think they took we had several. I think they took them all into their committee process.
Mm-hmm.
Yours was, did yours get added in late or something? They said they would put it in for January and February. It was one about.
Mine got added in late. Yeah, the one.
Not mine. Yeah, okay.
There's the one about civil service. Okay, they did that one. I will look through. I'll find they did send out a list of the resolutions that they're forwarding on that become part of their platform. So I'll go back and find that and send that to everybody, too.
I'd be interested in hearing more about what the process is once they accept them, then what? Where do they go and what happens and when do we show up in lobby? All right. I noticed that I had a draft email I was sending to you when you asked for agenda topics for Tiger that never made it, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask about. All right. Thank you, Martha. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis, Chair.
We met a couple weeks ago. If anybody wants to go back and look at that, there were two good discussions. One was Ithaca Area Economic Development, i.e. IAED, their 2021 work plan. We also had a great presentation in the beginning from Aloja Arweli and Kareem Beers. They have been working on the Energy Warriors program at Cornell Cooperative Extension, and that is a program that will be partnering with the Reuse Center, and that is a program that we have funded in this year's budget. So people might want to check out that conversation that happened in the beginning. In this next meeting, which actually I think pretty much Deborah covered all of it, just to reiterate, it is not on the normal fourth Thursday of the month. It will be Tuesday the 17th at 11 a.m. So mark that on your calendars if you want to watch the presentation by the Climate and Sustainable Energy Committee on the Green Workforce Development. And that will be in the second half of the meeting. And that is my full report.
Thank you, Anna. Any questions for Anna? All right, moving along. Complete Census Count Committee, my current chair.
Well, mm-hmm. A little later than we expected, but we had our final meeting on Monday. We heard final reports from all of the agencies and the legislators on the committee. Overall, I think we did a good job, particularly with with one hand tied behind our back because of the COVID crisis and not being able to have some of the public meetings we would like to have had, for example. But we had wonderful help from administration, Amy and Nick particularly. And then we were joined by Dominic, who has been great, from our Public Information Advisory Board, our county library, the rural libraries, League of Women Voters, people from the Latino community, for example, all in top of community action, and I'll miss some of them. I'm trying to say them all, but we are grateful for the help that they got getting us pretty much. I mean, the state says we're at about 99% reporting, but We'll wait to see the actual outcome of the figures. The colleges were wonderful, how they worked so hard to get the count on going back to April 1, both on their from their dormitories and group housing, and also later on their on the students living off campus. And that was a tough nut to crack. And we had great help from the census specialists from the United States Census. We asked that anyone who had comments, please submit them to Kathy Covert or me, and we would attach them to the minutes, trying to build up an archive for the next complete census count committee in 2030. And we'll all be there for that, I'm sure. That's pretty much it, and we kind of went out a little bit with a whimper rather than a bang, but I think we were successful in what we set out to do.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mike, for your work in chairing that committee.
You're welcome.
That was a heavy lift given what we were facing with COVID, so thank you, and for all the partners.
Had great help.
Yeah, thank you. Rich John.
Leslin, you just said it. You know, the census committee, you don't get on that and work on it for the glory. You do it because it just really needs to be done. And, Mike, thank you to you and all the people that worked on it.
Indeed, indeed. Any other questions for Mike? And thanks to all the legislators who also served on it.
Yeah, let's, you know, we should name them all. You know, we had Dave, and we had
Shauna,
and I'm going to forget them all at this point.
Yeah, Amanda
was there, and who else am I missing? Glenn was there. Glenn. So they were all great supportive characters, and we appreciated their help too.
It was glorious. It was glorious.
At 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, too.
Glorious. I started on it. And it was glorious at 9 o'clock on the morning. All right. Downtown Facilities Committee. Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Downtown Facilities has not met since the last legislature meeting. We will be meeting on the 12th on this same channel at 4 o'clock.
Thank you, Dave. Look forward to the meeting. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. Public Safety has not met since our last legislative meeting. We will be meeting on November 19th, 2 weeks from tonight, or today, at 3 o'clock. I do have a resolution that was pulled from the consent agenda, And this is Resolution D, document ID 9626, Budget Adjustment, Department of Emergency Response, and I would move it.
May I have a second, please? Second by Glenn Morey.
And I think there was a question on it. What was the source of funds? And it came from a grant that we received from State Homeland Security. It's an annual grant, and some of the funds were applied to buy screens for the Dewar site and the backup site. And so that's where the grant money was applied.
That was your question.
Yeah, thank you for finding that out. I know it's kind of nitpicky, but I think this is the permanent record of what happened. I think it's important to know where the money comes from. Thank you.
I agree with you, Dan.
All right. Anything else, Rich?
I just mentioned that our jail count, I like to bring that up so that we're continuing to pay attention to that. Is it 37? It's remained at historic low levels. So we're doing okay there. I think we need to vote on the resolution.
Yes, I was just about to go there. All right, roll call vote. Kathy's got the paper waving. Ready.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Sean Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grayson?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Ann Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Leslie McQueen Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 nays.
Thank you. That carries unanimously.
And that's my report.
That is your report. All right. Thank you all very much. Let's take the minutes of the previous meeting, the October 20th meeting, moved by Anna Kellen, seconded by Martha Robertson. Any discussion or substantive changes to the minutes? No? Let's vote on it.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morin?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 nays.
Minutes carries. Is there any unfinished business? All right. Now I need a motion to go into executive session. Moved by Deb Dawson, seconded by Anna Kellis. And we're going into executive session for the purposes of discussing real estate negotiations as well as a personal matter that relates to a particular person. All in favor of going into executive session? Kathy's going to call the roll.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Dunn?
Yes.
Ann Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morin?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 nays.
The executive session has been called. It is not our intention to take any action. When we come out of executive session, we will just be adjourning at that point. Thank you very much. Please give us a moment to shut down all the things we need to shut down, the recording devices and so on, and we'll resume shortly.